Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jason Singh, and I am the chairperson for ACCESS, the Australian Institute of International Affairs Network for University Students and Young Professionals. First of all, thank you to everyone for making the effort to be present at tonight's event. I welcome you to this wonderful debate, foreign aid or trade, what works, what doesn't, and why. Before we introduce tonight's topic, I would like to give a brief introduction to ACCESS and the AAAA. The AAAA is Australia's preeminent non-government institution, which has been exploring international affairs and Australia's foreign relations for the more than 80 years. ACCESS, as the youth network of the AAAA, aims to provide a platform for vigorous debate, analysis and networking while encouraging innovation in the field of international affairs for the broader youth community. In doing so, we are committed to fostering civil society discourse. ACCESS currently has two publications, Quarterly ACCESS, which is a print magazine and provides in-depth analysis of international affairs, and Monthly ACCESS, which is an online publication that can be accessed through our website. In 2010, ACCESS hosted 11 debates, forums and addresses. 2011 sees ACCESS coordinating the annual International Careers Conference and a Professional Development Day for university students. We offer an internship program to foster networking opportunities and promote professional skills development. And we have recently launched our in-house mentorship program. Now to tonight's debate, foreign aid or trade, what works, what doesn't, and why. I would like to thank Federation Square for donating tonight's venue. Thank you also for the support of the Graduate School of Humanities and Social Sciences of the University of Melbourne, as well as the volunteer members of ACCESS and the AAAA that have provided their time and assistance to ensure the successful organisation of this event. I would now like to introduce to you tonight's speakers. Our first speaker, Ms. Joanna Hayter, is CEO of the International Women's Development Agency. Previously, Joanna was the country director for Save the Children UK in Vietnam, as well as the African Regional Director for the Overseas Service Bureau. Our second speaker, Dr. Julia Newton-Howes, is the CEO of CARE Australia and a member of the Executive Committee and Board of CARE International. Prior to joining CARE, Julia was an Assistant Director General with AusAid. Julia is also a member of the Executive Committee of the Australian Council for Overseas Aid. Both Joanna Hayter and Julia Newton-Howes will make statements in favour of the aid argument during tonight's debate. Our third speaker, Dr. Tom Davies, lectures in public policy at the University of Melbourne. Tom has worked for the Refugee Review Tribunal and the Department of Immigration. He has also been a researcher and program manager at the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law. Tom's research interests include foreign aid and foreign policy making and Australia's aid relationship with Asia and the Pacific. Our fourth speaker, Mr. Andrew McLeod, is CEO of the Committee for Melbourne, Foundation Chair of the United Nations Global Compact Principles for Social Investment, and a member of the United Nations Expert Group on Responsible Business and Investment in High-Risk Areas. Both Tom Davies and Andrew McLeod will argue for trade during tonight's debate. Tonight's moderator is Reverend Tim Costello AO. Tim is CEO of World Vision Australia. He was made an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2005. He is a recipient of the 2008 Australian Peace Prize and is listed as a National Treasure by the National Trust. In tonight's debate, each speaker shall present their argument for approximately 15 minutes. After all four speakers have made their statements, each side will be asked to offer closing remarks. The audience will then be invited to ask questions. Tim Costello will moderate this debate and will assess the merits of each team's argument, offering a summary at its conclusion. Tim will then choose the winning side. Okay. I now welcome Tim Costello to take us through tonight's topic, foreign aid or trade.
Well, it's lovely to have the power I exercise tonight, and even lovelier that on a cold wet Melbourne winter night, so many people have come out to think about what are, I think, the great morally significant issues in our world, and to debate this issue, and hopefully we're going to take questions to be go away much better informed, maybe even entertained, but certainly morally challenged about what role you can play in that. Let me congratulate Jason and Access for doing this. Jason works at Urban Seed, an organisation I founded, and I can say that young people like Jason give me extraordinary hope for leadership, both in this country and in the globe. And thank you for setting all of this up and doing great work. One thing I never put on my CV, so I don't know where Jason got this, is that I'm officially listed as a National Living Treasure by the National Trust. Thanks for embarrassing me there. I should explain that apparently Australians in papers were asked to vote for their 100 National Living Treasures, and I was in the list. Don Bradman was still alive and lots of other people. I need to say I didn't see the invitation to vote in any national paper, nor have I ever met anybody who did and voted, but who am I to distrust the press? So I turned up to a gathering of 100 National Living Treasures hoping to meet Don Bradman and a few others, and I discovered that night it was a fundraiser for the National Trust at Sydney Town Hall. People had paid $1,500 a ticket to sit at a table with one of Australia's National Living Treasures, and they didn't know who they were going to get. And we were all introduced and we were guided to our tables. And I'll never forget the look on people's faces at my table when they realised they paid $1,500 for dinner with me. There they were, desperately hoping it would be Kylie Minogue, or if not Kylie, at least Ray Martin, and they blew their money on me. So that's one of the reasons I don't ever put that on my CV, but thanks, Jason. Well, it's a very serious topic tonight, and I think in this topic we've had a great primer. The lead opinion piece in Today's Age, which some of you might have read, is really on this topic by Hugh White, strongly favouring, I guess, the trade argument. So it's contemporary, it's relevant, and I, as a completely unbiased judge, will promise to be unbiased. But the quality of the speakers is just fantastic. You've heard them introduced, and I'll invite Joanna Hayter to come and speak first.
Let's get this all worked out. Good evening. Welcome and thanks for joining us tonight. It's just terrific. I so love this venue and I'm so thrilled to be in this situation. Let's talk about aid and trade. Let's talk about what works and what doesn't. Tonight, the four of us have been asked to consider what's most effective and efficient. What is the most effective and efficient means to assisting the developing world to achieve inclusive and sustainable development? That's the premise upon which we are going to discuss tonight's subject. Well, let me just start by saying that these key words, inclusive and sustainable development, are not issues that are important in market forces. And tonight's debate in relation to aid and trade will show clearly that aid delivered through community-based development approaches and usually led by the non-government sector is a process of empowerment and equality. Whereas trade, as championed by the corporate sector, is purely an engine that drives economic growth and more often than not results in increased inequality. Tonight, Julia and I will demonstrate that unless we tackle the underlying issues of inequality, trade has no place in the poverty alleviation question or equation, let alone in sustainable development. We're going to look at historical and present day examples that show us all clearly that if we want sustainability, then it is people in developing countries who need to be empowered, not private sector companies that need to be enriched. So what's the big picture? What is it about us, the non-government sector, and our approach that makes an essential difference? The work of international NGOs, or INGOs as we're often referred to, and those of us who take the community development approach, respects the unique culture, politics, geography, and economy of a region, a nation, a province, or a community. Our aim of a greater quality of life for all encompasses many things: foreign aid, governance, poverty reduction, human rights, gender equality, healthcare, education, natural resource management, and very many other issues associated with these things. We place an emphasis on redistribution, on social justice, on valuing local knowledge, and promoting equitable exchanges where external resources are required. Equitable exchanges. Our international and community development work in international settings is also closely linked with disaster relief and humanitarian aid, essentially those are centred around saving lives during emergencies. Trade and investment are an important element for sustainable development, but the imbalances that characterise and distort global trade and investment rules have to be addressed. Unequal and exploitative free trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties, which prohibit the very policies developing countries need in order to fight poverty, is no way to address sustainable development or to build a safer and fairer world. We see regional and bilateral free trade agreements introducing rules of liberalisation of services that drive local firms out of business, reduce competition, and extend the monopoly of large companies. Now, let me give you some examples of this. We've seen over the last few years, on many occasions and with great global debate, intellectual property rules that have prevented generic medicines from being produced, that would have given access or will give access to life-saving medicines for millions and millions of people. Rules. We've seen plant breeder rights legislation, which has prevented local farmers from being able to share seeds and self-select the strongest or best yielding seeds that actually just brings local food security. We've seen migration regulations, which are leading to brain drain and undermining economic and social development, or replacing, or are actually placing those individual migrant workers in incredibly dangerous positions where their labour rights are not upheld and the wages and conditions are disgraceful. Three examples. Behind these institutions that make these rules and set these policies are the northern governments and the transnational corporations who set the global agenda, who hold the purse strings and who hold the power. Essentially, these agreements undermine local economic governance within developing nations, and they transfer the power from governments to largely unaccountable multinational firms. This robs the developing nations of the tools and the capacity and the learning that these nations need to develop their own economies. The agreements exclude small business, trade unions, NGOs, women's groups, indigenous peoples, almost to the extent of zero participation, with their rights and their priorities ignored. They hinder investment in training local workers, sourcing inputs and resources locally, or transferring technology to developing nations. It seems that poverty reduction will always take second place to economic policies that prioritise the growth of wealth and profit, not its equitable distribution. The impact of trade expansion on the distribution of income and employment differs between men and women. We know that women are more vulnerable to chronic poverty because of the gender differences in the distribution of income and through a lack of access for women to productive assets like land or credit. We know that. We'll probably hear tonight from the guys on my left, that globalisation...
Let me just take note.
...and trade and investment into infrastructure have drawn millions of people in developing countries into paid work. What they won't tell you is that this labour is contributing to rising global prosperity and to the profits of some of the world's most powerful companies. But many of these workers, perhaps most of these workers, are still living in poverty even though they have paid jobs. Promoting models of development that rely on cheap and flexible labour for competitiveness, instead of investing in education and human capital, only reinforces gender inequality. It is imperative that we acknowledge and recognise women's contribution, half the world, women's contribution to the economy and workforce, both through productive and reproductive work, paid and unpaid work. Women form the majority of workers in most of the sectors that have been boosted by trade and investment agreements. Textiles, manufacturing, factory settings, agricultural settings. But what is the point of a wage that brings exploitation and hazardous conditions to an individual's life? And what is the benefit of a job that has long hours, low job security, no health or social security benefits, and steals a person's right to a family life while seriously affecting children's well-being? What is the point? Sustainable and inclusive development does not look like the picture I've just painted. The days of the simple notion that trade equals employment, which equals economic growth, which reduces poverty, are over. I put another equation to you. Our equation looks like this. That social and economic transformation equals equity, and that with equity comes empowerment, and with empowerment comes inclusive and sustainable development. The Australian Government, as many of you will know, have just released their new aid strategy, which takes us from now through to 2015-16. We're told that the fundamental purpose of Australian aid is to help people overcome poverty. If we're serious about aid effectiveness and helping people to overcome poverty, then we must understand that there is no such thing as poor people. There are poor men and there are poor women. There are poor boys and there are poor girls. And it is critical that we understand the specifics of their circumstances to plan aid or trade policies effectively. Aid for trade cannot be seen as successful or effective if some people are consistently benefiting more than others or some are consistently missing out. We choose to prioritise and invest in aid delivery and international engagement that places equity, inclusiveness and participation at the centre of our strategic approach. And Julia is going to give you some good, strong samples and examples of this to follow this on. The private sector, by itself, cannot give global markets a human face, and it cannot reach the millions of people on the margins. The NGO and community development approach can, but is currently limited in our access to the decision-making structures that open up global markets that address equity. So what's our position in the context of tonight's debate, and how does our team's approach help us to realise that? 6 points. Firstly, we acknowledge and address from the outset the unequal power relations between men and women in terms of access to and control over the resources needed to participate in today's political and economic systems. This also means addressing trade policies that affect men and women differently due to gender equalities, as I said before, in relation to access to land, information, economic resources and decision making. Secondly, we're the watchdogs. We're the analysts. We're the monitors and we're the recorders when it comes to governments and financial institutions being held accountable to the global human rights and gender equality conventions and commitments, and when we're negotiating new trade agreements or applying trade rules and policies. That's what we do. Our development programs include criteria for trade partnerships that raise the living standards for all, respecting human capital and community resilience. And this includes access to primary, secondary and higher education that brings the ability to create and apply knowledge and technology. It brings credit for women or marginalised communities. It brings basic services such as roads for transport, water, electricity. It brings access to markets, extension services, vocational training and social safety nets. It's holistic, inclusive and participatory. As civil society advocates, we challenge others to ensure the voice, in particular the voice of women, is included in trade and investment consultation and decision-making processes. We enable the provision of technical advice and support to governments of the day to better understand and improve income distribution, by ensuring the opportunities from trade include different groups of the population. This requires important work with ministries such as finance to ensure gender responsive budgeting, or statistical officers to compile and analyse sex disaggregated data or data that reflects racial and ethnic diversity. And finally, we will continue to build and strengthen supply-side capacity for local organisations and communities to expand their prospects and their choices in relation to their economic empowerment or sustainability, be it domestic or international. So let me conclude. We're now working within a new aid architecture. Julie is going to take us into a journey of the future. But at this point in time, the new aid architecture is one which our own government embraces. It's an architecture that is establishing global partnerships for poverty reduction that has human rights, people, gender equality and sustainable development at the core of its mandate. Wherever possible, this is integrated into national planning processes and national development strategies that embrace the diversity of community, the strength of civil society, and the voice of men and women equally, and at all levels of decision making, so that the conditions for security and sustainability can emerge. Economic development, including foreign direct investment and infrastructure, can only contribute to this if it draws upon and integrates the building blocks that we have established. Aid effectiveness and efficiency and inclusive and sustainable development is an approach that requires leadership by those who are best placed to respect equity and human rights. I'm with the NGOs and I'm proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanna, for both the argument and for passion. It's a very serious topic. I'd now like to welcome the first speaker for trade, Dr. Tom Davis. Thanks, Tom. Would you welcome him?
Thanks, Tim, and I'd also like to reiterate what Joe said. Thanks for coming out tonight on a very wet and cold Tuesday. As I was saying to the guys downstairs. I haven't actually done a debate since year 10 at school, and they always seem to be on cold, wet Tuesday nights as well. And Tim, we would call you Chair, so I'm going to refer to you as that the entire night. We would refer to Joe and Julia as our opponents, and Andrew is my colleague. And if this is like year 10 afterwards, I'll try and get the phone numbers of the Genizano students that we were debating against. No, things have changed since then. Although we could still try and get into the Skinny Dog Hotel down at Kew Junction. I've got fake ID, we'll be fine. So what are we going to do here? Well, my role with my colleague is to do the big picture stuff. So I'm going to try and blow your socks off with the conceptual frameworks and trying to get you to think about this relationship between aid and trade or between markets and government in a slightly different way. We're not going to try, and well, certainly I'm not going to try, and put forward one solution, one best way of this, that we can balance the way governments work and indeed the way civil society groups, NGOs work, and the way markets work, because there is no one best way. One of the problems with development, which my opponents and my colleague would understand, is that there's been a long history of searching for magic bullets, for searching for the one way to resolve the very complex issue of how do you get people out of dire poverty and into a position where, as Amartya Sen says, they have the capacity to choose the lives that they want to lead. It's fiendishly difficult. To say there's one best way is entirely problematic, and I don't want to do that. But I do want to get you to think about the sorts of processes, the conceptual processes you've got to go through in order to work your way towards some sort of a solution. I'm a political scientist. We don't believe in optimal solutions. That's why we're all such happy-go-lucky people. We know that that in dealing with complex issues like development, like the environment and climate change, like the myriad of issues that governments have to deal with on a daily basis, we know that you never arrive at best solutions. But what we try and do is unpack the journey towards getting ever closer to some sort of acceptable solution. And what are the sorts of things that you need to think about in doing that? And I want to take you through that journey as well. I would note that Joe hasn't said that trade markets are bad. She's merely said that they need to be civilised. Back in the early 1900s, that was what trade unions said, that they existed to civilise capitalism. And what Joe's been talking about has in effect been that. It's been about where do we set the line between what governments do and civil society groups do in order to control markets, fill in where markets don't manage to provide the goods and services they're supposed to provide. That's what she's been doing. We don't disagree with that. I think the debate here is about where would we draw that line and what sorts of things do we believe are important in the character of the markets that eventuate out of that discussion. So to begin with, what I want to do is first set what I think is the real heart of this question. As Joe noted, we do find ourselves in a very interesting period in relation to development and indeed in relation to global poverty. If you look at the most basic of figures in respect of global poverty, it seems to be going down. Just to take a couple of the headline statistics. The UN argues that the overall global poverty rate will fall below 15% by 2015, which is the target date for the UN's Millennium Development Goals. And the UN's original target for 2015 was a poverty rate of 23%, so they're going to beat that. Now, you have to bear in mind here that when the UN talks about poverty in relation to the MDGs, it's meaning an income of less than $1 per day. So they are talking about very extreme absolute poverty. The second headline item is that if you use the World Bank's figure of poverty or extreme poverty being when someone has an income of less than $1.25 per day, that there will be 900 million people living below that $1.25 line, poverty line, by 2015, and that's down from a 2005 figure of around about 1.5 billion. Now, these predictions, bearing in mind that both the World Bank and the UN statistics are not always above reproach, they do seem to be telling us a good news story. They seem to be saying to us that global poverty is gradually decreasing. Now, if this were the only story to be told, we could probably all go home tonight. World poverty is decreasing. Obviously, governments, NGOs, markets, private firms are doing something right. The balance of aid and trade that we're looking at here, the way it's working at the moment, seems to be getting the job done. What's the problem? Where's the debate? Well, and Joe did note this in one form, but I want to go into a little bit more detail. Obviously, this isn't the full story. If measuring poverty using a very basic headcount against that $1.25 per day figure obscures a lot of things. It obscures the enormous impact on the global figures, global poverty figures, of two decades of high GDP growth rates in China and India. If you take those two countries out, then the changes to global poverty are not nearly as impressive. Also, if you take China and India out of the equation, global income inequality, that is the differences between countries' average incomes, has actually increased over the past 25 years. There are also regional differences. While there have been some late improvements in sub-Saharan Africa, it's still a long way behind most other regions, and the Pacific and much of Central Asia have been flatlining when it comes to poverty reductions. And finally, even in those countries that have had considerable improvements in GDP capita per growth, such as China, Brazil, India, there's been a commensurate rise in income inequality within those countries. And in the case of China, this level of inequality between households and also between urban and rural communities is now matching and may soon exceed that of the United States. And the United States, amongst post-industrial countries like Australia, has got the highest levels of income inequality, around about 0.42 on the Gini coefficient, for those of you who know what that means. So now we have this phenomenon where many of the most impoverished people on Earth live in countries that are technically considered to be middle-income nations. And in 2009, around 150 million Chinese were still living on less than US$1.25 per day. And the problem with having high levels of income inequality within countries, and indeed globally, is that they are generally accompanied, eventually, by high rates of civil and social unrest. They often produce comparatively poor health indicators and a range of other social ills. So in this one topic, there are two core problems. How do we generate income to ensure that people are able to get themselves out of absolute poverty? And secondly, how do we ensure that there's some equality in this process so we don't wind up with a whole new other phase of global poverty? And so if you take these two things together, it's clear that the current relationship between aid and trade, or between government assistance and markets, is not working so well. And it hasn't worked very well for quite some time. What I want to argue, and what my colleague will then pick up on and add some empirical meat to, is that there are some fundamental problems with the incentives that drive decision-making in aid programs, in official aid programs. And these are incentives that NGOs sometimes challenge and this is where we're going to get some debate, sometimes abet. Maybe not necessarily encourage, but go along with. And it'll be interesting to see what we come up with there. And that in order to understand what these incentives might be and to think about how we might arrive at a better relationship between government and markets or aid and trade, we need to be aware of three things. And not surprisingly, what I'm about to say is related to political science, but it all leads to what I think we might take as our core word for our argument tonight, and that's innovation. But first, the first thing is we need to think of the process of development as involving a series of contests around power. And Joe did note this. That the process of moving people who may have been exposed to generations of poverty, to move them out of that situation, is inherently going to involve significant challenges to established power structures. Groups of poor individuals will need to challenge exploitative local governments and indeed sometimes local economic power structures. Poor countries need to be able to challenge unequal international power structures, and the relationship between wealthy countries such as Australia and poor countries such as those, many of those on our doorstep, they too need to be challenged, those relationships and the power structures that underlie them. So that's the first thing, power. The second thing, we need to think of markets and governments and civil society and even international trade regimes as institutions. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, what that means is that these are things that are not unchangeable. They are not set in stone. What an institution is basically a set of rules of agreed behaviour, of accepted behaviour, between actors. And those rules might have been different in the past and they might be different in the future. Our notion of what a government is was different 200 years ago. It will be different 200 years hence. The same with civil society and indeed the same with markets. So they change. They are the product of agreement between actors, between political groups, between firms, between NGOs, and indeed, when you're lucky, between citizens. And these have often been hammered out over a period of time, frequently with a lot of conflict along the way. Revolutions, as well as trade embargoes, as well as direct action, etc. So you don't change institutions without some sort of conflict. Third, changes to institutions have to be pushed by actors. Who are they and how do they do this? Well, I've named some of them before, but they are NGOs, and especially specific NGOs that try and work with other NGOs, and I'll get onto that in a minute. Bureaucracies. AusAid is an example of an actor in what we're talking about. Foreign Affairs. The Department of Foreign Affairs is an actor. Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd, they are actors. Tim Costello is an actor in all of this. And also private firms are actors as well. And how do they change institutions? They do it by forming alliances, by forming networks. They protest, they try and exercise some pre-existing advantage they might have for leverage. They negotiate, and it is difficult and it is messy, and in the truest sense of the word, it is political. So, if development involves challenging power structures, and those structures are embedded in the key institutions involved in the development, then some pretty big decisions have to be made by major actors as to what sorts of changes to those institutions they're going to try and make in order to redress power imbalances that create and maintain poverty. And the argument that I want to make tonight is that the way the institution of government currently approaches development is fundamentally flawed and requires changing. It is too geared toward supporting the national interest of the donor. The aid review was mentioned just recently. This is the latest in a long line of independent reviews to attempt to shift government's position on what the purpose of aid is and to downgrade the role of national interest in that. And this government, like every other government that has faced aid reviews who've tried to do this, has backed off on fully taking on board that particular recommendation. Government is too concerned with notions of management efficiency as opposed to development effectiveness, and this is in large part, I would argue, because of the low level of knowledge about development that our elected officials have, and therefore that impacts on the sorts of requirements that they put on the bureaucrats. But actors who work within the institution of government, so especially those actors in AusAid and DFAT, are too risk-averse when it comes to negotiating over power structures with other actors. And this is especially obvious when we look at the way in which donor and partner governments, rich and poor governments, negotiate and manage their relationships. And instead what they want to do is constantly search for that magic bullet, for that technical solution that is going to solve development. The problem of development. They are not prepared, they're too risk averse to engage in the very messy politics that we were talking about before. And because of all of these things, they are not innovative and they are not courageous when it comes to tackling the complexities of development. Now, markets are another institution. And what we would argue is that as long as the rules that underlie those institutions and the parameters within which they work are appropriately set, then these are institutions that do reward innovation and courage and challenges to established discourses. They do reward risk-taking. They do have inherent incentives for efficiency, and they do have the potential to generate the income required in order to get people out of poverty. And this is the case whether you're looking at a small and medium set of business enterprises in Bangladesh or national level policies in India to encourage investment in export industries. The global income growth that we have seen in the past 2.5 decades has been underpinned by these institutions. Markets provide the incentive structures to encourage individuals to undertake endeavours and also investment of their time as well as of their money that is necessary to create the innovation that you then need in order to generate income. But I said before the parameters and rules of the markets have to be appropriate, and this is where the balance needs to occur between government and markets. And governments are institutions that are well geared to set and enforce those parameters and rules. And this has to occur at an international level and with the trade regime, and especially in terms of ensuring fair trade as well as free trade, and in ensuring appropriate access, the appropriate access to developed countries' agricultural markets of developing countries. So developing countries can actually get in there and sell what they have at the market. But also at the local and national levels, developing country governments have got to be able to protect contracts. They've got to be able to protect intellectual property. They should not be encouraging corruption, official or otherwise. There should be some social protection in place and social safety nets. Markets don't always work. Who's going to provide public goods when markets aren't going to provide them? How are they going to do that? How are they going to respond to issues of gender and inequalities of gender within societies? That's what you need those governments there to do. You cannot have effective markets without governments performing their role. And also governments can even create new markets, such as for and around the environment and climate change. But ensuring that these rules and environments are appropriate actually involves all the actors I mentioned above to take part in political negotiation. And it is difficult and it's full of conflict and it is, as I said, political. AusAid and DFAT need to do more than what they've done thus far than simply put forward good governance programs, which they are starting to walk away from, and indeed programs that simply encourage infrastructure. They need to engage in genuine partnership dialogue with the countries to whom they are providing assistance. And they've been pushed to do this by the OECD, but if you actually look at the way in which these negotiations occur, what you will see is often a replication of existing power structures. Or if there has been a challenge, it has been because the developing country involved has actually managed to expand its market presence and is starting to be able to present itself as a real player in international markets. Civil society has got a role here. Civil society groups, NGOs, can be supportive of advocacy networks, especially transnational ones. They can push official development agencies like AusAid and indeed firms to be more, to approach markets in an appropriate way and to approach governments and especially southern governments, developing country governments in an appropriate way in order to ensure that the parameters and rules of those markets are properly in place. But they also have to be aware of not getting too close to government. And I know that the people on my right deal with this on an almost daily basis. to what degree do we accept AusAid's money? On what conditions are we going to do it? Where does that leave us in terms of our capacity to be able to advocate what we want to advocate? And so this is what I said before. Sometimes you challenge, but sometimes it becomes very tricky to know exactly where that line is being drawn in terms of whether you're actually supporting what government is doing and not pushing it to challenge those power structures. Private firms have also got a role to play, and they have to do things like understand that there's going to be a variety of rational actors, that this, what they think of as rational economic behaviour is not always going to occur in every single place around the globe. They also have to be prepared to open up their shareholders to education about development issues, because it's through that that they're going to attain some sort of accountability. And what I'd finally say is that people are indeed the subject of markets. They can't and they shouldn't be denied opportunities to engage in market-style behaviour where they can be rewarded for the risks that they take, for the innovation that they try and achieve. And that unfortunately what we have at the moment, in very broad terms, is an approach towards aid and trade that is actually in large part denying that to occur in all of the places where it should be occurring. And my colleague is going to pick up on that and take it a bit further, and I'll leave you with that.
Well, thanks, Tom, and I think you've really come on since you attended school and debating. Any of the Genizano girls here tonight might have wished they did take your number back then. But I often say on a serious note that actually beating poverty is about disturbing power. And I think that's been a refreshing framing. Our next speaker is Dr. Julia Newton-Howes from CARE, and would you welcome her?
Thanks, Tim, and thanks, Tom, because I thought for a while there you were arguing for us, and I actually think you were. So terrific, you can shift table if you like. I agree that markets can provide incentive structures for innovation and wealth creation, and we saw a bit of that in the subprime mortgage crisis in the US, where there was very innovative structures come forward. And we absolutely need to have an informed and critical civil society in order to really tackle these issues of what is innovation and what is downright stupidity. So anyway, look, where I really wanted to start my talk was just to reflect on the topic for this debate, which is aid versus trade, how to best assist the developing world to attain sustainable and inclusive development. So what I'd like to say to you is, what do you think a community looks like when it is sustainable and inclusive? Do you think that community would be a place where children are all vaccinated? Do you think this is a community where all the children go to school, no matter whether they're boys or girls, whether they have a disability? Do you think it's a place where everyone has enough food to eat? And not only that, but it's nutritious food that allows them to grow up and be healthy. I think it's a place where both men's and women's voices are heard in decision-making, where all our views are taken into account in terms of the future directions of that community, where people have access to decent work, which pays a wage that they can live on. This is a community where people live with dignity and with a sense of security, not just about today, but also tomorrow. So let me take you in your minds to a place called Ratnakiri. This is a province on the eastern part of Cambodia, up next to the border with Vietnam. And CARE started working in Ratnakiri about 10 years ago, and actually this time next week I'm going to be there, and I've visited it several times because some quite remarkable changes have happened in this place. When a CARE team first came into this community, the whole province was heavily forested. The communities, the population there were largely drawn from ethnic minority people, about 23 different ethnic minorities, each with different cultural traditions and different languages. And more than 80% of the ethnic minority communities were illiterate. And we came there and started to work with these communities because they were some of the poorest people in Cambodia. And their expressed need to us was a need for literacy. They felt that they knew that when they went to the market to sell their produce, they put their produce on the scale and the guy would say, oh, that's 7 kilos, this is how much I'll pay you. But if their children were numerate and literate, they'd be able to say, actually, that's 9 kilos. But if you can't read the scale, you can be cheated at every turn. They knew that they could not interface properly with the local government structures because they needed to speak Khmer in order to interface with those structures. And the problem why these communities had such high levels of illiteracy is because the schooling in Cambodia is in Khmer, and the kids would go and there'd be a Khmer teacher from another part of Cambodia, and the kids couldn't understand the teacher and the teacher couldn't understand the kids, and they soon parted company. So with a range of different funding, some was AusAid funding, but mostly private Australian community funding, over the past 10 years we've built community-based schools, not right across Ratnakiri, but through a significant proportion, where ethnic minority people themselves have gone through intensive training to become teachers, both young men and young women, where they have helped to create their own school materials that tell their own traditional stories, so they're not looking at school books which talk about kids in Phnom Penh who live a very different lifestyle to themselves. They're actually, the school books tell their stories. There's the first dictionaries have been created in some of these languages, not all of them. And we've now, 2 years ago, saw the first cohort of children, a complete cohort from initially 6 schools, but now it's more than 30 schools, have graduated from primary school. And we've now started working with secondary school, and it's a bilingual education model. These kids become literate in their own language, they transition into Khmer, and they transition into a national school. But more importantly than that, we worked with the government of Cambodia, and the government of Cambodia has changed its education policy to now recognise the importance of bilingual education, and we are still training teachers from the government of Cambodia's education system. Now, over those 10 years, life hasn't remained the same for these people. There's a big road that's been built in from Vietnam in, and it's been built through Cambodia across to Thailand. These communities are communities that practice slash and burn agriculture. There's been a lot of in-migration of people. There's been some significant economic interests have come in. They've taken land to become cashew nut plantations, and so a significant amount of economic growth has happened in Ratnakiri. But the ethnic minority people haven't seen much of that. But as they become literate, And it's interesting to talk to some of the elders in these groups about what it means for them that their children are now literate, that they can write to the governor of the province, that they write to the people in power to put their case for what they need. They're no longer afraid of being cheated at the market. This has made a really fundamental change to the lives of these people. So that's what aid does, and let me give you a big picture statistic about aid and children. You know, currently about 80% of children in developing countries receive a basic set of vaccinations, which helps them to survive to their fifth birthday. Half of those vaccinations are being supported through aid programs. So aid is making a huge difference to some of these basic building blocks. I've talked a bit about our education program, but this can be multiplied many times. Aid is creating schools and classrooms and education systems that respond to the needs of communities in poor developing countries around the world. Those people, those children can grow up, their voices are more likely to be respected, they have the skills that they can then participate in the economy and demand from their governments, demand a fair go from their governments. I think aid is providing the basic building blocks in so many places. And I've talked about it at the level of children, but I'd also like to say that we know that women in poor communities lack access to productive assets. They're much less likely than men to be able to access credit. They're much less likely than men to own land. Inheritance rights often mean that women get left out of opportunities that economic growth can bring. And aid and microfinance is another story. None of these stories, I mean, I agree with Tom, there's no silver bullet here. None of these stories don't also have cautionary tales attached to them. But microfinance is a massive success story in, for the first time, allowing women to have access to basic financial services, allowing them the opportunity to turn their lives around. And over the last 2.5 years, CARE has provided basic financial services to 2.5 million women in Africa alone, making a massive change to their lives. So I think, when we say what is the role of aid or trade in creating an inclusive and sustainable community, I think the record of aid is to create an environment in which an inclusive and sustainable life is possible. Economic growth has massively changed the world we live in, and I'm really pleased that Tom talked about economic growth and the way in which the economic growth that we've seen over the last 20 years has massively exacerbated inequality in the world. And many economists will argue that we shouldn't worry about inequality, because if we're seeing economic growth, we're bringing people out of poverty, and that's what you need to focus on. However, it's interesting that in last year, two different reports came out. One was the Spence Commission on Growth and Development, which tried to understand the fundamental building blocks for economic growth. And the other was the 20th anniversary publication of UNDP on the Human Development Index. So that measures human development as a function of income, of health indicators, particularly life expectancy, and educational attainment. So it's a broader concept of poverty than simply income. And if you look at the 10 countries that the Spence Commission ranked as the best achievers on economic growth, it's pretty interesting that only four of them show up in the UNDP's list of countries that have done spectacularly well, are the best achievers in terms of human development. So whilst growth is an important ingredient to poverty reduction, it actually, it can be less or more successful in reducing poverty, and a critical factor is the empowerment of people and of communities to be able to access the benefits of growth, to be able to participate in the economy. And I think our aid program is fundamentally about enabling people to benefit from growth and to be able to temper growth as well, because I think another really important part of development is to recognise that development is not simply about outcomes. It is also about choices, human rights. It's about recognising the aspirations of this community. What do we want our future to be? What does this community in Ratnakere want its future to be? And to be able to express those wishes and both for both men and women within communities, to be able to determine what outcomes they are seeking from growth and development, for those not to be dictated by ourselves. You know, this phenomenal growth that we've seen in the last 20 years is pretty interesting. And one of the things that the Spence Commission said about this is that, you know, if current trends continue, we'll see world GDP triple in the next 20 years. And actually, that is likely to create massive pressures around the world. And so it's pretty important that we do have communities who are empowered to take a role in directing what they want to see from that growth. And I think it's also really interesting to look at, you know, as we move towards 2015 and the outcome stage of the Millennium Development Goals, where are the remaining pockets of poverty? Well, some of those pockets are places like Somalia, where we have, you know, a government that's basically non-functioning. We have warring clans. But actually, those pockets of poverty are also really importantly in middle-income countries. In fact, right now, 70% of the poor in the world live in middle-income countries. And they're poor because they were born in areas of social disadvantage. They were born to a parent with disability who wasn't able to participate in the economy. They were born into groups who are discriminated against. A significant proportion are female-headed households who are trapped into a system of a lack of assets. And I think that the aid programs that we are involved in, that the Australian government is seeking to implement through its revised focus, which gives a lot more emphasis on poor people, is about ensuring equality of opportunity to provide those building blocks so we do have an inclusive society that can debate and determine its own future. And that is fundamentally what community-based approaches to development deliver. And it's not clear to me that the market has really anything to say on that at all. And I'm just trying to find my wrap-up points. Let me just make three points to conclude. Firstly, development is a social and political process that's equally about people's participation and engagement to claim their rights as it is about development outcomes. Secondly, reliance on market forces will simply entrench undemocratic elites, increase inequality, and do little for poverty. And thirdly and finally, the future of the world over the next 20 years will be different from the past 20 years. Economic growth and aid have both played a key role in overcoming poverty, we've seen. But going forward, we must see that aid will play a much more important role in creating an inclusive and sustainable society. Thank you.
Thanks, Julia, and thanks for some wonderful practical stories. Anyone who has been involved in this area cannot help but be inspired when you go and hear some of the stories, such as we heard from Cambodia then. So our final speaker for trade is Andrew McLeod, who's really a mover and shaker here in Melbourne, and great to have Andrew part of this debate. Would you welcome him?
Thanks, Tim, and it's a real compliment to be called a mover and shaker by yourself with all the great changes that you've made in Australia over the years. Julia started off by asking, what does a community look like when it has reached development? And I actually think there's a really easy answer. Look to your left, look to your right, look behind you, and look in front of you. A community when it has reached development looks like this. When I worked in Rwanda, I was often asked, why do we need to comply with human rights and things like this? And my answer was always the same. If you get it right, you get Melbourne. This is ultimately how people can live. This is one of the best places in the world to live. And any way we measure either aid or trade, it should be in aid or trade's ability to bring people from some of the least well-off in the world to the life that we expect and live and treat as normal. I stand before you tonight, perhaps somewhat counterintuitively when you look at my CV, particularly that I've spent most of my adult life working in the aid world in some of the most difficult contexts around the world, countries like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, most of the countries in the world ending in Stan, and those that have a really big warning at the start of The Lonely Planet, and the places that only mad Australian tourists go, as one speaking in favour of trade and not aid. I speak not from the back pocket of Newt Gingrich or those radical right-wingers of the United States. I speak from a perspective of one who has spent 15 years with dirt under the fingernails in some of the most difficult of circumstances. I stand before you today not as one concerned of the interests of major international corporations or massive international aid organisations. I stand in front of you as one concerned only of the people. People like a girl named Maria, who at the age of 12 fled from the Serb Krajina and ended up in an orphanage in a little town called Sombor near the border with Vukovar. Whatever she'd been through in Bosnia had caused her to close down, not speak, not laugh, not cry. In fact, the name Maria was given to her by the orphanage because they couldn't get through to her. And it was at a summer camp in this orphanage that this girl decided at one moment to put her head against my shoulder and start to cry. Aid and Trade is about girls like Maria. It's about the four kids who used to wait each afternoon outside my house in Kigali at the age of about 8 just to play with a football, with a white guy, a Muzungu, at the end of the afternoon. And those four kids had very little hope of reaching their 15th birthday. Aid and Trade is about them. What I am not going to say tonight when talking about trade is that trade is the silver bullet. I'm not going to say that the market can solve all problems. I'm also not going to say that we should be turning our back on the poor, because if we believe that a society should be judged by how we treat those less well off, not those more well off, that equally applies on a global scale. We should be judged not by our intent, but by the results in our effort to bring the people out of poverty. What we are saying tonight is development investment and not development aid
is the ultimate goal. For here in this room, we do not have an expectation that our child will go to school with the assistance of some well-meaning person in Kigali, or that the school itself will be built by the taxpayers of Mozambique. And we should aim that the people in Rwanda and Mozambique have exactly the same objective as we do. We build our economy and our lives off investment. We should get other countries to the level where they can take for granted that which we take for granted too. There is a role for aid to supplement trade in the initial stage, but the end point objective, where we need to get, is so every economy in the world can be like ours. I seek to make 3 points to you tonight. One, the aid world is far less effective, far less efficient than we either hope, realise or should accept. Two, the corporate world at its best is more effective and efficient than we thought we could hope, could imagine to realise, and should become something with hope rather than scepticism in our hearts that we look to as a way of helping bring the world out of poverty. And then in realising those 2 points, I'll go to point three, that surely we can craft the world full of strong partnerships where the call is not for doubling of foreign aid, but doubling development effectiveness. Aid and trade bring an economy to an end of the day where aid is no longer needed. That should be our objective. For at the end of the day, the best aid is a job. And a job from a corporation where both the employee and employer pay tax to a responsible government, and that responsible government spends that revenue on schools, hospitals, and the future of their country's children. And some will be sitting in the audience tonight saying that is a naive hope. It is a hope to return to the rest of the world nothing but what we take for granted. That should surely be the standard. Let me move to my first point. The ineffectiveness or inefficiency of aid. Let me set the context. I call this the swimming pool moment. I used to be a competitive swimmer, and in every country I worked, I volunteered my time to help the national swimming team. In Pakistan, the junior foreign affairs minister was also a swimmer, so we trained together, and we got to the end of the lane one morning, and I turned to him and I asked, "Why is it that you're involved in politics?" And he returned to me without batting an eyelid, and he said, "I'm here to protect my family's land interest." I asked a minister in the Philippines a similar question a couple of years later and asked, "Why are you involved in politics?" And without batting an eyelid, he said, "I'm here to protect my family's financial interest." The truth is, in most post-tribal and most post-feudal societies, those who are dressed up in a cloak of democracy are nothing more than the former feudal overlords and the former tribal overlords who are there to protect their families, land and financial interests. You see, we make a mistake in the West. We look at our governments, Labor or Liberal, and we assume they're trying to do the right thing by the people because if they're not, they get tossed out at the next election. And we transpose that assumption into the developing world, assuming that those governments also have the best intention of their people in mind, and the truth is simply not that. Most people in most developing countries, with few exceptions, are there to protect their family's land and financial interest. It is why there are billions of dollars in bank accounts in Geneva under the name of Mobutu Sese Seko, even though that country got billions of dollars from you. I wish it weren't true. But it's not just me saying this. Ugandan journalist Andrew Mwembe said, "All previous efforts to improve development aid mechanisms have failed because precisely this aid is part of the problem." He said, "International aid today was given on the wrong assumption that it reached the people who needed it, whereas most of it ended up in the pockets of politicians." Mwembe concluded that the main challenge facing Africa today, and these are his words, not mine, was not to help the poor, but to create an environment to create capitalist growth. He's not alone. Dambisa Moyo, in her book Dead Aid, speaks about it a lot. She calls it a failed system of income accountability and aid dependency. Think about this. The Democratic Republic of Congo government gets nearly 80% of its revenue from foreign aid, not the taxpayer. Are they accountable to the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo? And the answer is no. And then a really hard question. If you cut off 100% of official development assistance to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and remember, since the Paris Declaration's official development assistance, government to government, must pass through the host government. If you cut off 100% of overseas official development assistance tomorrow, what would happen to the poor people in the Democratic Republic of Congo? And I would submit to you, very little. What would happen to the government's ability to repress those poor people? And the answer is a lot. If you cut off 80% of the government's revenue, it cannot fund in the same way the repressive regimes and mechanisms. I wish this were not the truth, but I have seen it in more than 6 war zones and 10 natural disaster settings. The mechanism itself has failed. The Paris Declaration that requires us to send aid through a host government objective is simply wrong. The system is full of short-term views and short-term funding. Where within the UN, an organisation I spent many years, a long project was 2 months, maybe a year, maybe two, because project lengths lined up with the contract period of the staff who were implementing it. Very little 10, 15, 20-year long-term plans. And really, the anecdotal evidence is clear. So many countries have benefited from billions of dollars of aid, yet remain poor. The countries that have effectively pulled themselves out of poverty, Brazil, South Korea, we're seeing China and India, Mozambique, Rwanda and Botswana are making a lot of recent progress. Rwanda, an incredible country. 1994, without a shadow of a doubt, the worst country in the world immediately after the genocide. 2010, a country with an infant stock exchange, 21 tradable commodities, and moving up the scale of Transparency International's anti-corruption mechanisms. How and why? Largely by telling the West to take their aid agenda and going to hell, because the Rwandans, partly rightly, blame the West for allowing, if not permitting, the genocide to happen, have decided to develop a market economy result, a market economy progress towards pulling their people out of poverty. And no country in the world has progressed as well as Rwanda has in the last 16 years. Paul Kagame, the President of Rwanda, will be here in Melbourne the day after Cup Day. We hope he'll be giving a couple of public presentations. The aid world is less effective than we hope. It's less effective than we realise, and it's less effective than we must accept. But let me move to trade. Let me move to the second part. Is trade but a minor player in bringing the world out of poverty? Consider this. 53% of financial flows from OECD countries to the developing world come through the private sector. 30% come through remittances. That is, people with a job in the West sending money home. Only 17% comes through aid. So it's not that trade is a small kid on the block, it's actually that trade is the big kid on the block. And if we're actually wanting to bring the world out of poverty, should we be concentrating on the 17% or the others, or looking for the partnerships between both? But am I just being naive? What about the corporations? Aren't they big and evil? Let me take a supranational corporation with a global footprint and a long-term vision, BHP Billiton. BHP Billiton is the world's largest miner. It's the fifth largest company in the world, and it's the third largest development agency in Australia. Sitting behind only the Australian government and World Vision, but in front of the Red Cross, is BHP's community engagement programs that invest $200 million a year worldwide. In the internal documents of BHP Billiton, not the external blah-blahs, the internal documents of BHP Billiton, they list the number one objective for engaging in community investment is to help achieve the Millennium Development Goals. When I first read that, I nearly fell off my chair. A, that a company had even heard of the Millennium Development Goals. B, that they saw that they had a role in helping achieve them. And C, in their internal documents, listed it as the number one objective in doing so. Let me give you an example. Around Mozal in Mozambique, BHP runs an anti-malaria campaign that's reduced adult malaria infection from 88% of the population to 8%. It's a wonderful, warm and fluffy program. But why would they get involved in that? Well, it's also reduced absenteeism in their workforce because of the improved health, from 22% of the workforce to 2%. It feeds directly into the bottom line of BHP, to which some people here would be tempted to say, aha, they're doing it only because it's linked with profit. To which my response would be, firstly, I don't care. It's still reducing adult malaria infection from 88% of the population to 8%. But actually, no, wait, I do care. The fact that there is a link with profit is what makes it sustainable over a longer period of time. If it was a mere philanthropic handout, if under some sort of financial pressure, if, I don't know, a big country with 50 states just happens to default on its debt in a couple of weeks, would they be interested in cutting that program? Maybe they would. But if it's actually a program that is about enhancing staff, why would they cut it? And the answer is they won't. It's actually sustainable. And is it a 1 or a 2 year plan like a UN program? No. With a life expectancy of 50 years for their assets in that country, they plan that program for 50 years and set aside 2% each year to ensure that there's a sustainable funding model after BHP leave. I'm not saying the private sector are all good, and I'll caution that. But we need to encourage that sort of link with profitability, with social outcomes and financial outcomes, with corporate footprints. It is why we have brought to Melbourne the new United Nations Secretariat on Social Investment, to be able to encourage good corporate behaviour. Remembering that Melbourne is the philanthropic corporate social responsibility and humanitarian hub of Australia, it's a brand image that we should and can build for this city. While Geneva might be the global hub of the public sector delivery mechanisms in the world, wouldn't it be wonderful if we make Melbourne the private sector hub for developmental delivery mechanisms? The real power is linking development objectives and commercial objectives, not trying to hide from the link, not poo-pooing them, but actually celebrate what works, because at the end of the day, you are the beneficiaries of the operation of private sector. Why can't we allow other people to take for granted what it is that you take for granted? Evidence shows that countries break the poverty with a development investment rather than a development aid mindset. When looking at it like any investment, I'm putting something in and I expect something back, either in financial or in social terms or both. Not just giving money in a hope that something will happen, but give money with an expectation that it will. And the aid industry doesn't hold itself accountable. I've written many UN reports that say something along the lines of, we were given $100 million to implement this literacy program. We spent $97 million, therefore, that's 97% spent, therefore, it's effective. And I challenge you to Google tonight any UN report and you'll get something along those lines. What you will not see in any UN report is, with that 97 million, we moved the population from 14% literacy to 24% literacy, and that 10% shift over a population of 100,000 stacks up when compared with a similar program in another country. You will not see that sort of accountability. I wish it were there. So point three, if aid isn't as effective as we need it to be, and the private sector perhaps is a bit better than cynically we believe it to be, then how do we bring the two together? We've been experimenting in Melbourne with an aid trade roundtable. We brought Peter Baxter, who is the Director General of AusAid, to Melbourne to meet with the community investment focal points of some of our biggest companies, BHP, Rio, ANZ, NAB, Optus, Telstra and a few others. Bruce Harvey, who runs the community engagement for Rio Tinto, summed it up really well when he said, Peter, in the developing world, you build roads and ports. In the developing world, we build roads and ports. Why the hell aren't we building roads and ports together? Really good point. Did you know in the 50 countries where we concentrate our aid program, we spend around about $4 billion growing over the next few years to $8 billion in aid? In those same countries, we do $90 billion of trade. Which is more likely to help bring the world out of poverty? What we really should be doing is sitting down with the aid and trade world and dividing up the areas of comparative advantage. And what do we actually need to do in the developing world to give them the ability to take for granted what it is that we take for granted? Principally, you need to have lower corruption. You need to have transparency of exchange rate mechanisms, allowance of repatriation of profits, and the enforceability of contracts under local laws. And then you create the macro and microeconomic variables where business can go and invest. Regulated business, not unregulated, regulated in the same way that we regulate business in this country. The variables for business to thrive so more people can be employed, and as I said earlier, the best aid is a job, and a job where you pay tax, and that tax is used by a responsible government to build schools, hospitals, you never know, maybe a pink bat or two. Development investment supplemented by development aid until such time as countries are freed up from the need of aid. Stopping aid should be our objective by removing the need. So allow me to conclude. What are our results for the nearly $1 trillion of aid that's been paid over the last couple of decades? Are we really bringing the people out of poverty? The way of measuring is not have we tried, it's have we succeeded. This should be the only measure we apply when asking, has aid worked? At the end of the day, the measure we should use is not the feeling of good by the giver, nor the image, nor the intent of the delivery institution. It's the impact on the people, like Maria, like my four friends in Kigali. The anecdotal evidence is clear. Aid has not been an efficient way of bringing the world out of poverty. If the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, then the way we deliver official development assistance is the best example of insanity I have seen. The countries that have progressed have taken a private sector route. Use development investment supplemented by well-targeted development aid until such time as a country can be freed from the aid shackles, until one day people all over the world can live in dignity without relying upon the goodwill of others. At the end of the day, it's the impact on people, and it's our ability to let the rest of the world live as we do. That's how we should judge aid and trade. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very stimulating. We're now going to have some time for some questions. And that's from you. And then there's going to be one speaker from either side to have a 5 minute summing up. And we'll let you get off to dinner and out of here. So if you'd like to ask a question of any speaker, preferably a question then a comment, then please raise your hand and I'll elect you. Not all at once. Where's the... Oh, up the back. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for that. I've got a question for the aid team. I'm from sub-Saharan Africa, and for about 40 years since a lot of the independence of a lot of countries, they haven't progressed a lot. But China in the last 10 years has developed so much infrastructure, are investing so much in factories, construction, companies, and they're bringing in a lot of Chinese, but they're doing so much for the local community as well. But that's because they're getting something out of it as well. So they're trading, but for their own purposes as well. But they're doing so much more, they've done so much more in the last 10 years than aid organizations in the West has done in the past 50 years. So what's your comment? And I know Kenya is a favorite of a lot of aid organizations. What's aid done for countries like Kenya that China has not been able to do in the last 10 years?
Who would like to respond? Joe or Julia?
I think China's investments in Africa are really interesting, and I'm no expert on it, and I think we look forward, like other commercial investments, to see the outcome. But, you know, fundamentally, aid is an opportunity to ensure that people can determine their own future. So you might be lucky enough to have the Mozal aluminium smelter next to you, but you'll be able to take better advantage of that opportunity if you were vaccinated as a child, if you had a decent education, and if ultimately your voice is heard within your community. It's not for me to say what Kenya should look like, Kenya should, or Nairobi should look like Melbourne in 10 years' time. You know, this is a decision for Kenyans to make. But my, you know, our argument around aid is that it helps to create an educated and empowered communities that are able to participate in civil life and bring about those changes. I think it was interesting to hear Andrew say, well, these sorts of investments reduce corruption. Well, I'm not sure they do. I mean, I certainly, as a, you know, aid organisations, we don't pay bribes in order to start investments, and clearly many companies are totally ethical and don't either. But, I think that there is a clear comparative advantage for aid, which is around empowerment of people to fulfil their own aspirations and, you know, providing those basic services.
Thank you. Is there another question out there? Yeah.
Hello. There's a lot of theory around aid and why it's a good idea and how nice it is, but I have never heard an aid individual give an example of a finished project that has led to long-term sustainable improvement and development for that country. They're always talking about projects in the middle of and how well they're progressing right now, but after 50 years of international aid, I was hoping, you know, maybe you can give one or two examples where it has clearly been beneficial.
How long have you got? How many examples can we give?
No, I'm not saying there aren't any, I'm just being serious. I never hear an example like...
Okay, that was very loud, I'm sorry. One comment by way of introduction. When we talk about aid, we are, in the context of tonight, we're talking about sustainable development, which is not necessarily aid. That's the context of the debate, so that word has been used a lot. However, I think we have to be careful when we're talking about development and aid programs about what we mean, whether we're talking about projects or whether we're talking about programs or whether we're talking about partnerships or whether we're talking about contracts. And I think the delivery mechanisms within aid are very diverse and a very, very wide spectrum. So that's just a statement I would make. Let me give you a good example. Within non-government sector, an Australian volunteer program sends one Australian couple to Swaziland 15 years ago. That couple come with some skills, a bit of work in the Trades Council in South Australia, and they go to work with a small collective of women who have said they want to set up a small business. Turns out that the skills that those women have and the access to the resources that they have is local vegetables because they're growing them. And they know how to cook and manufacture those vegetables into achars and chutneys and things like that. So the connection between the Australian aid workers and the local women in that village in Swaziland is a connection of exchange of knowledge, exchange of business skills, exchange of understanding markets, and developing something together. And what happened was that those women began as four women and two Aussies, a married couple. Within 2 years had moved from two stainless steel cooking pots and one gas burner with some jars being sold in the local market. Today, every hotel in southern Africa, most of the fair trade and a lot of the other supermarkets in Australia, in fact, and many other countries I know as well, I've seen it in England and I've seen it in the United States, now have a brand called Eswatini Kitchen, which is selling jams, chutneys and various other condiments to a global market, has turned into a massive private sector enterprise, and began with a community development approach that respected the rights and choices of local people and brought international engagement together to make that happen. It's now a globally viable business. One story.
Could I make a deeper point, though, which is that You know, when we're talking about sustainable development, it is a long-term process. I mean, I think a flippant remark would be, actually, most of us put evaluations of our projects on our websites. World Vision does, CARE does, Oxfam does. You can actually go and see the results. You know, I can talk about projects where we saw, you know, malaria incidences decreasing in Cambodia, the extent of hunger being decreased in East Timor. But that wasn't an end point, because social transformation is something that goes over a long period of time. We're often reaching out to some of the poorest, most marginalised people. We get them, you know, we work with these communities, their lives change, they're no longer the poorest people, many interesting and good things happen, but their lives go on and they need other things. So, you know, I think social transformation is a long and complex program. Clearly just vaccinating kids is not the end of development. So I guess I would just say maybe that's also why you feel nothing ever ends, because, you know, this is a long process of self-determination.
Since World Vision was mentioned, I know I'm the moderator, but if you go to our website, you'll see that we publish transparently those places where we stay. Our model is staying for 15 years, working across every single sector. So it's health and economic growth. It's so we get a trade aid debate. But aid agencies, certainly like us, believe very strongly in economic growth and businesses across water, agriculture, HIV. And after 15 years, we leave. It's why child sponsors get often upset that we've told them we've left and that child is now in a sustainable community. Why? Because we don't want to create dependency. And there is success. We also transparently publish where we fail and say this didn't work and we thought it should have, but it didn't. And so we're very upfront about that. And I just make, you know, the very simple point that one of the reasons of working across all sectors in our model, I envy NGOs that say we just do health or we just build houses. We said there'd be 70 houses and now there are 70. You can have your 70 houses, but the water supply is still polluted and the HIV rate's still raging. So sustainable development in our model of 15 years is actually working across all sectors, including setting up chambers of commerce and a whole range of things. And I invite you to go to our website and the others to have a look at that if you're wondering. Do we have a question for the trade side? Okay, thanks.
Hello, thank you. I've really enjoyed some of the points that the trade table has raised, but I'm trying to apply them in the context of the Pacific Islands, and I think the Pacific is an area that hasn't been mentioned tonight. We've mentioned Asia and we've mentioned Africa. We've mentioned countries that have resources that are of interest to business. When we're talking about, say, a place like Kiribati, where they don't have the resources that may be of interest and all they have to sell at the end of the day is their human capital, and so we're seeing a lot of people leaving the country, we're also forgetting about the social impact of that. We're forgetting about the social impact of, say, a situation where the majority of people that are leaving are men. And we've had that recently with the New Zealand's regional migration scheme, allowing Pacific Islanders to go over there and work in the horticultural industry. But at the same time, it means for women that are left back at home in the village, not only do they have the burden of looking after family, they also have the burden of picking up the farming that's required. So I'd like you to address that. One other point is the impact on traditional economic systems as well, systems that have been in place for many years that are very solid for the redistribution of goods through communities.
I can start.
Are you starting?
I actually had down here Pacific may be the exception. look, and it was interesting. Last year I was involved with a workshop actually on social accountability with the Australian Council for International Development, which is the peak body for development NGOs. And various NGOs were talking about their experiences in working with partners in various countries, etc., etc. And they always came back, and then there's our operations in the Pacific. And it really is difficult. One argument you would say is that there is a market there. It's a labour market. It does have some of these issues. And then one of the things that you would then be expecting of a adventurous, courageous government aid agency is to think about, well, how to respond to that. How could AusAid, well, NZAid no longer exists, but how could AusAid, for example, work with those communities and with markets here in Australia in order to somehow or another get around some of those issues? Because basically when it comes to the fundamental elements of international trade markets in terms of does a country have a competitive or comparative advantage in the production of one particular set of goods or services, a lot of the Pacific countries are just not going to meet that. So you have to have some sort of intelligent combination of aid and markets. I suspect that in the case of the Pacific, that with some of the countries there, there is actually an argument to be made for an ongoing element of aid, but looking towards how various markets, be they tourism, labour, etc., can be, I guess, more intelligently constructed out of this. On your second point, while I agree with you, there are a number of markets of the type that you describe, which are local level community economies, market economies, and some of my experience has been in Papua New Guinea and the Highlands, and you can see some of it happening there. I think it's also, I'd also warn against the idea that there's some sort of, you know, prelapsarian paradise in these communities that needs to be protected from the big bad world. Mm. The big bad world gets in anyway, and I think it's really about how can these communities best manage the way in which they interact with that outside world. Do you want to add?
Yeah, I'd bring a couple of other additional perspectives. ANZ, for example, does a lot of really good financial literacy programs throughout Asia and the Pacific, empowering people with individual financial literacy, empowering them to be able to take small business loans, mortgages, and the sorts of things that we take for granted. I was interested in part of your question where you said they had nothing but their human capital. That kind of sounds like Victoria. You know, building an economy on tourism, services and human capital is something which is a really good idea, actually. So long as you look upon nothing but human capital as something as a real objective if you build up that human capital. Rwanda is something similar. Rwanda's got a bit of tin, a bit of coffee, but sweet bugger all else. And what they're trying to do is really pick up their human capital as well. So I think that... in essence, of part of your question is they had nothing but human capital, you're actually dismissing their strongest point, which is the strongest point of this economy too. Now, we love to say, Victoria, Melbourne's a knowledge economy. What exactly does that mean? It's hard for us to point to things coming off the production line or things being dug up in the ground, but it's any longer in Victoria. So looking at those areas of human capital growth are very important. Into your point about traditional economies, I'll probably make two or three points. My father used to work with the indigenous communities a lot in the 1950s, and I think one of the most admirable things about many of the indigenous economic systems within Australia is they achieved something that no other community in the world seems to have achieved, and that is contentment. And that's something to be admired. Lack of contentment drives change, and change drives growth. So it's a funny balance there, and I don't mean to be patronising to either those that achieve contentment or those that don't achieve contentment in moving forward. And you ask yourself, what is the traditional base of our economic system? And the answer is there isn't one. We've continually evolved. We, you know, in the period of European economic systems, capitalism hasn't been around really as a driving force for a long part of it, and regulated capitalism as an even shorter part of it. So when looking at a traditional economic system and say almost in essence to your question, do you preserve or enhance that? Well, I'll go back to my definition of insanity. Don't try and preserve a traditional economic system if you're wanting a different result from that which it's already achieving. If you're wanting a different result from that which it's already achieving, then it needs to change. If you don't want it to change, you've got to be happy with the result that it's achieving. And that's the balance you have to make.
Thanks. Who's next? Who's got the mic?
Up the back here? Yep.
Thanks. I'm probably going to demonstrate ignorance here, but I'll ask my question anyway. You're talking about, for a little while I thought maybe you were just saying with the trade argument, do nothing is really what the argument is let the private sector do everything and government should just keep their hands off and stop weakening countries with aid. But you were talking a lot about development investment. So I'm wondering what you consider the role of government to be in the development investment process. Yep.
I certainly, and I went out of my way at the introduction to say it's not a silver bullet, and I said, you know, private sector is not going to provide all the answers. So let me clarify that. Development investment is a very important concept because it has two components. Investment is demanding a return. It doesn't have to be a financial return. It can be setting your objectives in the social returns that you're wanting. I'm investing this money and my return is seeing literacy raised from 12% to 30% or what have you. And I also did say during my presentation that I thought there is a role, particularly in building four or five main areas that only really government support can do, which is transparency of exchange rate mechanisms, repatriation of profits, anti-corruption, enforceability of contracts under local laws, and setting the microeconomic variables. And I said right from the beginning, our end objective should be bringing economies to something similar to where we are, which is a regulated capitalism. Deregulated capitalism doesn't work either. So there is a role for a sensible government in collecting taxes, in building hospitals, in building schools, setting a sensible regulatory mechanism. But I agree with my opponents, as my colleague told me I'm supposed to call them, the end objective is not our government imposing a system on other countries. It's empowering other countries' governments to be able to have a fair system in their countries, but equally punishing governments, and I use that word quite deliberately, that are not prepared to do so, such as Mobutu Sese Seko's government, as it then was in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there is importance for us to understand the difference when looking at the results of either aid or trade, in measuring the difference in efficiency and effectiveness. I can spend $1 million and move a child 5% in literacy. Well, it's been effective, it's done something, but was it the most efficient use of resources in achieving that development objective? And child sponsorships were raised, so let me raise the hackles a little bit. If I were to advise people who are considering undertaking a child sponsorship, to ask the organisation that's providing that child sponsorship not what it is that they will do with the current generation, but what is it that they have done with the previous generations. World Vision has been doing child sponsorship since, I think, 1953 and has now sponsored worldwide around about 1 million children. The top 8 child sponsorship organisations since the mid-1900s have sponsored around about 3 million children. And we've put about $30 billion towards child sponsorships in the last 20 years. A really good question to ask is, have we got not just only a result, but an efficient result for that money? And there is so few studies on the end results, the end impacts. Now, how many doctors are there who would not have been doctors if not for the child sponsorship program? How many teachers if not for the child sponsorship program? How many lawyers? How many businessmen? That's the question we should be asking. Not how many teachers and how many schools were built to educate a child, but how many children moved through that education and pulled themselves out of poverty. One of the only two studies I could find on the internet by guys named Kremer, Mullen and Namunio in 2003 did a study that showed that the average child sponsorship improved child's time in schooling by 0.3 years, that is, 4 months. And the cost of these services, about $28 a month, the average sponsorship was about 11.33 years, which meant that the average sponsor was giving $3,806 for a 4 month improvement in education outcomes. There's a legitimate question to ask whether those organisations were providing efficient results or whether you could have used that $3,806 for a better end. Now, I know World Vision's probably at the top end of the efficiency scales, but the questions that we need to be asking ourselves are not what we're doing, but what we've achieved, especially now that we've moved into the third generation of child sponsorship, for example. And you can put that across all of the aid sector. ask the hard questions of what has been done in the past, how many people have effectively been brought out of poverty, because as I said at the beginning, it's not about how we feel in giving. It's not about the intent of the organisation or the impression of the organisation. It's got to be the results that count.
I might just exercise the moderator right here.
What a surprise.
Total aid, and we're not just talking about child sponsorship here, is 1/3 of 1%. Islands of the world. Defence is 13 times higher. When you think aid has helped eradicate polio, and Bill Gates believes very strongly in aid with malaria prevention, I think it's quite remarkable what aid has done when it's so little money. But when you raise child sponsorship, which is still minuscule, I'll just throw a question to you, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Mining companies in Africa are avoiding $160 billion of tax. Mm-hmm. Total aid around the world is $100 billion a year. All the rich nations, $160 every year. In Zambia, one of the reasons the government can't actually collect tax is the mining companies have employed them all and pay them far much more, and they help avoid tax. So if we're going to talk trade, let's talk about the really big money and the big avoidance going on.
Oh, look, I'm very happy to talk about that. And I know, Tim, you sit on the board of Business for Millennium Development, and you sit next to the senior executives, the most senior executives of the biggest of those companies. So I'm sure you and Karen have these discussions at times.
I certainly do.
I'll go back to what I said. The best form of aid is a job where both the employer and the employee pay tax to a responsible government, and that government uses that tax to build schools and hospitals. I said that right from the beginning. And one of my objectives is, if we don't assume that the private sector has a role to play in bringing the world out of poverty, then we won't really hold the private sector accountable. If we assume the private sector does have a role in bringing the world out of poverty, not only should we hold the aid world accountable, we should then hold the private sector accountable too. And questions like that, Tim, are really legitimate, but will only get answered if we truly accept the private sector has a role in bringing the world out of poverty, and we decide as shareholders to hold them accountable in doing so. Interestingly, let me put it smack bang into the Australian context, super profits tax debate. I've spoken to some senior Australian people in some of the biggest companies, I won't mention which, who have said off the record, you know, it was our bargaining position with Kevin Rudd. We as Australians recognise that if the government had have created a mechanism where the expenditure of the super profits tax would have been something we could have supported, particularly going into a sovereign wealth fund. As Australians, we recognised that we needed to convert our natural asset to a financial asset. That's fine. Don't have it spending on recurrent expenditure. We would have been prepared to make a contribution, but the government didn't call the bluff. They knifed the Prime Minister, and many, and you know some of them, are sitting back going, you know, we would have been prepared to put in a little bit more if it went into a sovereign wealth fund. So the thing that we always assume is that corporates are evil and are run by greed. Now, I want to just get a quick show of hands, if I may, Tim. Who here works for a company, any company? Put your hand up if you work for a company. Keep your hand up if your company is evil. All right? Here's a challenge, because we're quite happy to say, you know, most companies are evil. Oh, yeah, but not mine. And I'm sorry, maybe I'm naive and maybe I'm idealistic. You know, there's that old saying, if you're not idealistic when you're 18, you have no heart. If you're still idealistic when you're 40, you've got no brain. I'm happy to say I've got no brain. Every company I know is run by people. Most people I have met want to leave the world better off than they found it, and many of them use a corporate as an avenue to providing an outcome. But your point is right, that we are not yet holding the private sector as well accountable as we could, because we as a community don't see...
Let's go over here.
Can I just come in at that point? Because you used the magic word, which was people, which is what I thought tonight's discussion was about. So I'm just going to shift it away from economics for a minute and remind ourselves that when we're talking about poverty, it doesn't just mean the presence or absence of money. Mm. That poverty is a state of mind. Poverty is a situation in which we find ourselves. We move in and out of poverty on a daily basis, a weekly basis, or within a lifetime. Poverty is so much more. When we talk about poverty alleviation, we're not talking about money. Money is a tool.
Economic growth is an approach, it's a strategy. Corporates believe that with economic growth and with economic investment will come greater amounts of money, preferably profitable amounts of money, into our economies, which will change the quality of our life. It is a very, very narrow view of this world. We have to stop thinking money as the solution. And we can't talk about this as economists, and we can't talk about this in terms of poverty being measured by some indicator that says we are poor if we earn less than $1.25 a day. Rubbish. It's rubbish. The way that the world currently measures poverty is done at this point in time by a poverty indicator that measures the amount of income at a household level and does not break down that income in terms of who in that household is earning that $1.25. So the point is not so much the amount. The point is about how many people are in that household and who is it in that household to any level or to any extent has the capacity to earn any money, has the choice to look for work, has the ability to gain access to some workforce. It's so much more than economics. It's so much more than poverty measured in dollar value. And I just want to stop at that point.
Can I jump in on and make two quick points on that?
No. What I'm going to do is invite final responses, because I think we're sort of getting into them. If you're not making a final response, certainly, are you doing yours?
I'm doing the final response.
So you can make that comment there.
We decided that on the phone last night.
Although I might add something as you're going.
You go ahead, Tom, because you're not making a final response. You've got a final comment before Andrew speaks.
Yeah, I'll just make a final comment. I didn't want to get involved in your knife fight before because I might have got hurt. We keep coming back to this question of how do you ensure that markets, corporates behave appropriately. And that was very much at the heart of what we're on about. And I think it's also at the heart of the point about it's not just about money. Of course it's not just about money. However, the money sure helps if you're going to get the virtuous cycle of having taxation that then gets expended on human development outcomes and also on issues to do with gender and changing structures and all those sorts of things. The point that I was trying to make in my talk, and which was coming up, I think, with some of what Andrew was saying, has definitely come up in the later discussion, is how do you get there? How do you ensure that at the international level, companies are held to account and also countries are held to account? And at the national and local levels, how do you ensure the same thing occurs? How do you ensure that markets operate effectively and don't wind up creating worse power structures than the ones that they replaced? And it comes back to the role of government. And the point I was trying to make in my talk was that the way in which official donor agencies like AusAid tackle that problem is entirely inappropriate. And one of the reasons is because they're so concerned ultimately of national interests. And sometimes what's in the national interest might not be in the interest of challenging other governments. But it's a very difficult political process to go through. And I think the appeal that we're trying to make here is that in order to get that effective aid versus trade relationship, you need to be very cluey about how you play that political game and what sorts of alliances you build, be they with NGOs, other governments, and indeed with the private sector. So that's the key point that I want.
Thank you. Who's...
I'm going to do that.
The finishing.
But that, is that the
so, point? Julia, would you just like to make a comment? There's a five-minute finish from either side. I've got to be absolutely impartial.
So are you asking each of us now to make a statement or one from each team?
Just one from each team. So I think Andrew's doing it from this team, final 5 minutes.
For our team. If that's all right.
So are you inviting me to make a statement before...
I am. That's what I'm doing. Yes. I'm sorry I'm so unclear.
Clearly the private sector has a role to play in development, but that issue of accountability that Tom raised is fundamentally a role for civil society, and an empowered civil society is, you know, is what we in the aid community aspire to provide. I think when we look at economic growth, you know, it's important to remember that a country has to grow at 7% a year for a decade in order to double its GDP. And for countries like Mozambique that, you know, their per capita GDP is $300, $400, you know, it's going to take several decades of this sustained economic growth to get to a point where through tax returns they can provide a decent level of services consistently to their citizens. Actually, there's only 13 countries in the world that have grown at 7% a year for 25 years. And certainly the economic models that they chose were important to that. But you know, the same economic model that worked for Korea is not going to work for Rwanda. So I think aid is an important opportunity to support the aspirations of poor communities. I mean, unless you think, just let them wait 40 years until they've just grown enough on their own account. Thank you.
Andrew, your final summing up.
My final summing up is, I'm going to start from a bizarre point. Hands up if you're excited at the quality of debate that existed in the last federal election. I don't think there are many people who are currently inspired by the quality of our politicians, because our politicians at the moment are giving us a choice of fear. They're giving us a choice of scepticism. They're giving us a choice of negativity. Part of what we are talking about tonight is trying to create a choice of hope, removing that scepticism, removing those preconceptions, and looking at unusual partnerships, and looking at ways to effectively deliver outcomes. Because at the end of the day, we do want to be holding people accountable. Whilst we accept the development on the trade world must be held accountable, we're also saying within the aid world, it must be held accountable. There are too few books like this, independent review of aid effectiveness and having a look at how aid actually has worked. So we would agree, and in mixed partnerships, where we have true accountability. And in mixed partnerships, let me give you another unusual one under this umbrella of choice of hope. Having been one of only two male gender advisers in the UN system, I know very well the issues regarding age and sex desegregated data and needing to look at vulnerabilities of women and men, boys and girls, in particular environments. One of the more proud things I have been involved in my life was immediately after the earthquake in Pakistan, we were able to increase girls' enrolments in schools in Kashmir by 50%. And we did it not through an academic neo-feminist look at things, and nor did we do it through one of the more usual organisations. We'd had plenty of people come to Pakistan and say girls were not going to school because of, you know, sexism, because of impositions by Islam, because of a male-dominated society. The guy that came up with the idea of how to improve women's enrolments and girls' enrolments in schools said, Andrew, this is crap. It's not repression by men. It's the girls are spending between 4 and 8 hours a day collecting water. What we should do when we build houses is build taps. And when building taps, girls don't need to collect water. They can now go to school. The guy who came up with that idea was a fellow named Lieutenant General Nadim Ahmed. Who would ever have thought a Pakistani male army officer would have come up with the idea that increased girls' enrolments in schools in Kashmir by 50%? There are a whole series of unusual partnerships out there that we are not maximising. We are not maximising the partnership between private and public sectors in bringing the world out of poverty. I know Tim believes that to his heart, sitting on the Board for Business for Millennium Development. We'll finish off by saying this. Yes, we believe in accountability of the private sector, but accountability of the aid sector as well. The judgment should not be our intent in giving. Our judgment should not be in the impression that an organisation gives that they are well-meaning and trying hard. The only measure that should count if we're trying to bring the world out of poverty is, have we succeeded in bringing the world out of poverty. Not the mechanisms that we're trying. We've built this school or we've built that hospital. Have we educated a child and has that child got a job? Is that child growing into an adult who then has a child that's benefiting from a child sponsorship or being able to pay their own way through school? Ruthless accountability is what's needed if we're going to truly bring the world out of poverty, and that ruthless accountability applies to the private sector, to the public sector, and to us in recognising the opportunities and building unusual partnerships and giving for us a choice of hope, not a choice of fear. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Joe, for the Age side.
Thanks, Tim. Now, this is the fun part of debate because I think this is where we're allowed to get a bit cheeky. So let's see how we go. I think tonight the premise of this debate was aid versus trade, and we were asked to consider that discussion as it related to effective approaches to bring about inclusive and sustainable development. We were asked to address that in the context of the approach that, in the main, the non-government sector takes versus the approach that the corporate sector takes. That was the discussion we were asked to address. So Tom, the wonderful, wonderful Tom, helped us to do that. He was incredibly close to our argument for almost half of his presentation and strongly agreed with our point of view that inclusiveness matters, that coalitions help, and that together we are stronger and more accountable. So thanks for that, Tom. That was terrific. He then moved on and did challenge the notion around power. It was important that we talked about power in tonight's debate because essentially power is at the point of catalyst if we are going to truly achieve inclusive and sustainable development. The power that we're talking about is not just the power within the current rules, systems, membership and structures of the corporates, although that's very significant. The power is around the entire cultural setting, the entire architecture in which aid or trade exists, and that structure is a patriarchal structure. It is a structure that does not include diversity and does not allow representative voices from across society. So we continue to believe that until those structures can be changed to address and include all members of society, we will not see sustainable, let alone inclusive, development. Tom talked about markets. We finally got to markets, the market forces, which, as we said, are not what is driving change and are not interested in inclusiveness or sustainability. We believe clearly that market forces are here to embrace growth, but growth that brings profit, therefore vested interest. But when Tom did address markets, he spoke around local supply and demand and talked about the importance of voice and decision-making around domestic economies, all good stuff. The point was it all got mixed up with the corporate trading approach. Yes, we agree local supply demand is very important. Yes, we agree local markets are important. But that was not the point we were trying to make about the global corporate trading system. And we think that the approach within the corporate trading system at the moment is unsustainable and non-developmental. We were warned, don't get too close to government. And yet we were told, we have to work together, we need representation across all sectors, and that together we can make and hold governments to account. So should we get close or should we stay away? It's sort of missing the point around participatory decision making. We don't sit stagnantly in one sector. Indeed, a characteristic certainly of the Australian workforce is that many of us move across sectors and bring that experience with us in understanding how the different sectors work. It's that dynamism in workforce. It's that ability and that democracy that we have to engage with government on any level and at any point in our lives that we choose that gives us the opportunity for more sustainable development. It's the decision-making that we need to influence in terms of getting close to government. We need to be at the table to ensure the decisions are effective.
1 minute, Jane.
Thank you. Andrew, I think you've missed your calling. I just
was really just sort of not sure whether I had a sensational economist or a sensational journalist at hand. But I have to say that I think anecdotal evidence was confusing and contradictory. And we saw, for example, a statement that said that the trade flows far exceed the aid flows. But I think that you'll find that those statistics are highly variable. Certainly the trade flows to China far exceed the aid flows to China. But if we look at development finance aggregates in sub-Saharan Africa from last year, the total ODA to sub-Saharan Africa was $42 billion, and the total foreign direct investment in sub-Saharan Africa was only $28 million. So I think we have to be careful about saying this is the whole picture. It varies by country, it varies by region, and we have to be very careful when we're drawing global analysis on that. We talked about the responsibilities and the investments that we're seeing corporates starting to make in terms of human development. And an example that we heard about was Rio, I think, who had chosen to invest in malaria prevention programs for their workforce, and I think that's terrific. What I do question, however, is the incentive behind that. Was the incentive to prevent workers getting malaria because they cared about an occupational health and safety and workers' rights, or was it because it improved productivity in the company? And I suspect the answer was the latter. We heard Andrew talk about remittances, as remittances being a good thing. But I think the point that's missing about this, and which Julia tried to raise, is that as GDP increases and as the economy grows globally, the patterns of migration are going to be seriously chaotic and seriously worrying. Remittances exist because people follow the money for work. That includes legal and illegal migration and is bringing significant vulnerability both to individuals and families. We can't miss the reality of migration. Finally, my comment before, that poverty and poverty indicators seem to be connected with money, that the corporates seem to identify and analyse our responses to development and human development and sustainability in monetary terms. This is a small part of a spectrum that brings quality of life to all and respects the dignity and rights of all. We rest our case. We believe that aid delivered through non-government and civil society, human rights-empowered organisations, is the way building blocks for the future, and we welcome trade and the corporate sector to be a part of that. But please build on what we have developed and understand that the longevity and the sustainability comes from human integrity, not profit. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it now falls to me to make a judgment, and having showed my hand and jumped into the debate, I'm going to avoid doing that. We have been asked to make a judgment on how this debate went by the organisers, so I'll be faithful to that. For those who think the trade side made out the case and won the debate, raise your hand. But thank you. For those who believe the aid side won the debate, I'm going to declare it a draw. And
ring the bells.
And thank you so much for all coming. Before you all leave, and I think you'll all agree with me, it's been a fantastic event. Kristen Lewis is going to come and offer a vote of thanks and present some gifts. Thanks, Kristen.
Wow, what a debate. I assume that we have so many people standing up because they think the same thing. My name is Christian Lewis, and I'm the events coordinator for ACCESS, the youth network of the AIIAV. I would like to thank the following people and bodies for making tonight's debate possible, successful and overwhelmingly insightful. Federation Square for once again providing ACCESS with such a centralised, modern and appropriate venue and assisting us throughout the organisational process. Our event partner, the University of Melbourne's Graduate School of Humanities and Social Sciences, for their promotion of this debate and providing our compelling speaker in favour of trade, Dr. Tom Davis. from Access itself, I would like to thank the entire events team and others within the network who helped organise and promote tonight's event over the past several months. From the AIIAV itself, I would also like to thank the Executive Officer, Peter McDermott, for her assistance throughout the process. And by the way, for any more information on the AIIAV, Access and our upcoming events, please see the desk on the way out. I would like to thank you all, the audience, for making an appearance here tonight and taking part in our event. I trust you learned something. I certainly did. And finally, it is my honour to congratulate tonight's four speakers. Miss Joanne Hayter and Dr. Julie Newton Howes from the AIDS side. Mr. Andrew McLeod and Dr. Tom Davis from the trade side. And how can we forget our renowned moderator, the Reverend Tim Costello, AO. Please assist us once more in giving a final round of applause for our speakers, moderator, and all of those who made tonight possible. Thank you.